This is 1A. I'm John Donvan in Washington, sitting in for Joshua Johnson. And today we're going to be focusing on several different groups of people, different kinds of people who made headlines this week, a lot of headlines. We are talking about refugees. We're talking about farmers. We're also talking about some very talented musical artists. But first, we're going to be starting with that One Degree of Separation group, associates past and present of President Trump, because they really dominated the news this week. And I have a great group of journalists who will be joining me for the Friday News Roundup. Let's meet them. First, Sarah McCammon is a political reporter for NPR. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Nice to have you here.
Yeah, thank you.
Also, Alexis Simmendinger is a national political correspondent for The Hill. Welcome to 1A. I'm great.
Good
great
to see you again.
You too. It's been quite a while. And Josh Kraushaar is political editor at the National Journal. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here, John.
Before we get into the One Degree of Separation group, a piece of news dropped right in front of us today. Related to the America's gross domestic product, the famous GDP number. Before we reveal the number that was released this morning, I want to talk first about President Trump's comments yesterday in Illinois and Iowa. He was saying this before the report came out.
On Friday, numbers come out, and I don't know what they are, but there are predictions from 3.8 to 5.3. And if somebody would have said that when I was running, if I would have ever even thought that. And, you know, I've been saying, frankly, I've been saying we're going to do awfully well.
Well, it turns out the president was in the ballpark on that one. The number came out this morning. The GDP growth reached 4.1% this past quarter. It has not been that high in at least 4 years. Joshua, start with you. How remarkable is that number?
Well, this is the best political news that the Trump administration has gotten in quite a few weeks. And look, the 4% number is favorable to anything that the Obama administration had in their 8 years in office. You have to go back to the depths of the recession and coming out of the recession that the Obama administration got in that ballpark. And look, Republicans badly want to run on the economy. That's what they want Trump to focus on. His comments this morning really accentuate what Republicans want to hear. But they're worried that the administration is going to focus on trade and focus on immigration and focus on issues that aren't quite as favorable to this administration. They think if people are voting on the economy, if Trump is messaging about the GDP growth, that's a winning issue. The worry is that he will not stay on message.
And also, often the president has been accused of trying to change the subject to other news that might be more favorable to him. But in this case, Alexis, this really isn't a false subject change. This is a big deal.
Oh, it's a very big deal. And any president would have been delighted and would have tried to announce this with the kind of cheer and enthusiasm that the president used today. I did notice, just to follow on what Josh was saying, that the president did inject a little partisan spear in his comments by talking about Democrats not voting for the December 2017 tax bill. Mm-hmm. And he managed to get his little dig in there to describe to voters or Americans who are thinking about this, as he was describing the reasons that he thinks that the economy is doing so well. And of course, he wanted to seize a lot of the credit for that, talking about, and in fact, even talking about his trade policy. And he said at one point, as trade deals come in one by one, and that was an interesting comment to me because he is under tremendous pressure from his own party in states that he won in 2016 because of the trade policies. And we have not seen these trade deals that he's describing, that he's working on, especially his pressure on China. So that was interesting.
Given, Sarah, that these things are so complex, the economy is so complex, and there's always a lag time from a policy being put in place until you actually see impact, can the president legitimately claim any credit for this number coming around?
I mean, I think that's a good question for economists. Obviously, he's been president now for more than a year and a half, and I think any president in this situation would certainly take credit. But as you say, it's complex. There are so many things that go into the GDP, some things which the president can control, other things which he cannot. And I think, as we've heard, I mean, the big issue is for Republicans, they do want to stay focused on the economy. But even as you look at the economy, there are some mixed results. you know, farmers, this is why Trump went to the Midwest, I think, in part this week. Farmers have really felt the negative effects of some of his economic policies, his trade policies, because of the retaliatory trade measures from China and other trading partners in response to Trump's steel and aluminum tariffs. And, you know, you don't want to upset farmers. You don't want to upset red states and ag states. Those are a big part of the president's base. So this is great news for him today, and I expect we'll hear a lot more about it in the coming days.
You think he might talk about it some more?
He might. Certainly Republicans want him to, and not some of these other things that are going on.
One other element of what Sarah's saying that struck me listening to the president, I was waiting to hear what he would say about wages, because in the economy right now, the administration and economists talk about full employment, but we know so many Americans feel that there's this lag in terms of having a job and actually earning or being compensated for their work. And the president wanted to underscore what's happened to manufacturing wages, but he did not dwell on what's happening to any of the indices about wages nationwide for the average worker. And I did think that that was notable, because that is not an indicator that is as strong as the administration would like.
And there's also some concern that the numbers are artificially juiced, ironically, because of the trade war, because of the threat of tariffs. That threat made a lot of overseas buyers want to stock up on soybeans and pork and a lot of these goods that where tariffs were imposed. And that means that there may be a decline in an upcoming quarter. So this, you talk about the political impact in some of these farm states. Sarah was talking about the worry that Republicans running for office are having. There are a lot of farmers that traditionally vote Republican that are seeing their bottom line being affected negatively. So this may be a sort of a lagging indicator. The leading indicators economically may not be as rosy for Republicans and for the White House.
Interesting. We have an email from David in Plainfield, Indiana, says, I do not feel the GDP is sustainable. The trade wars that have started will take time to resolve and are going to slow the growth of the economy, and the extra money repatriated and gained from the tax cuts was not spent in a way that will continue economic growth, but that was a short-term economic gain for most companies in the form of stock buybacks. I'll wait to see what the numbers from the next quarter look like before I really celebrate, kind of the point that I think that you were making, Josh. Let's pivot now to the Russia story, and by the Russia story, that there are a lot of Russia stories in play. So the part that I'm talking about is the investigation, Mueller investigation into Russian interference. Of course, in the 2016 presidential election, the issue of possible collusion with Donald Trump's campaign. Sarah, it was revealed this week that Michael Cohen, Trump's one-time lawyer and one-time personal fixer, actually recorded lots and lots of his conversations with his client, Donald Trump. And an audio recording was released this week of Trump and Cohen apparently talking about a payment involving a Playboy model who said she had an affair with Donald Trump. What can you tell us overall about these tapes?
Yeah, and of course, Trump has denied having that affair and continues to deny it. We've known that those tapes were out there for a while. We've been hearing that, but the new thing this week was actually hearing part of the tapes. Big questions. I mean, first of all, I think a lot of us, probably most of us, have heard the tapes maybe many times by today. And they're noisy, they're muddled, they're a little bit hard to understand. It does appear to show a discussion of a payoff to this Playboy model who claims to have had an affair with the president. And it appears to show the president, you know, talking about that, which would establish, if that's correct, that he did know about this and that it happened.
And that's important. Why?
Well, because he's denied this. And more importantly, what else is on the other tapes? Mm-hmm. There have also been reports now that Cohen, his former lawyer, is saying that and willing to testify that Trump knew about the June 2016 meeting with Russians in Trump Tower, that this is the big meeting that has been, you know, such a focus in the discussions of the Mueller investigation. And that would be even, you know, bigger news if that can be established.
And Alexis, how many more tapes are there, do we think?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a discussion that there's at least 12, a dozen, that had been turned over. But there's also a discussion that's really interesting, too, because it involves journalists, and that is that Michael Cohen was in the habit of recording conversations he had during interviews, probably for protective purposes. Mm-hmm. And he was interviewed many times by journalists. And so there has been reporting that there might be 100 of those kind of conversations. Some of those are with journalists. Some also may include conversations with President or then-candidate Trump, his client. The extent to which we may end up hearing more of these conversations is probably what's really tantalizing to a lot of people. Just to add to what Sarah was saying, one of the reasons why the prosecutors are interested in looking at this first soundbite tape, this clip, is because there's a question about whether the president's use or knowledge with his attorney of a payment involves him in campaign finance law. So there's a legal jeopardy for the president and his team if this entire discussion was part of the campaign. Remember, this conversation that we've heard occurred in September, just 2 months before the election.
I want to return very briefly. We were talking about Michael Cohen's role, the fact that he's now under pressure. His tapes have been captured and one of them played. But the whole issue of the fact that his lawyers released this tape, Josh, what does that do to his credibility as a witness and his ability to make a deal?
Well, it looks like he's trying to restore his credibility. I don't think this helps him from a legal standpoint. Presumably, this would be part of some negotiation he would want to have with the Mueller team. And he's just, these are just getting out in the media and undermining perhaps his legal case. I also think that there's a big distinction to be made between the political and the legal track of the Russia investigation. The tapes of Karen McDougal, the Playboy model, and the campaign finance violations that could come up as a result of that are certainly damaging to Trump legally. But the newest revelations that Cohen says he knows that President Trump knew about this Trump Tower meeting with his son, with Jared Kushner, with these Russian representatives, that is the political smoking gun. That is what people could change their views of the Trump administration if some of this these allegations from Cohen are corroborated. So, I think, and people know that Trump, his moral character is not held in high standard, even from his supporters. So I don't know if the political impact of the McDougal situation is going to be that significant. That Cohen is now talking about possibly knowing about this Trump Tower meeting and the president's knowledge of that, that's the bombshell that we're looking at.
An important context for that, which, Trump's people are pointing out, of course, is that Cohen has some reasons, some potential motives for, wanting to make a deal potentially with prosecutors, for wanting to get friendly with Mueller. He's in a lot of legal trouble. He's under investigation. So as you're looking at all this news that's coming out, it's important to sort of look at who has something to gain or lose from this bit of information. But the other thing about Cohen is... I'm curious about who he's trying to send a message to. Is it Mueller that I know stuff, I'm willing to work with you? Is it the president? Don't mess with me, I have dirt on you. And maybe even journalists, considering he may have tapes of journalists. Who knows? It'll be really interesting to see what else he's got.
Certainly is enigmatic. Alexis, listen to this email from Don in Traverse City, Michigan. Don writes, "It appears the Mueller investigation is finding all kinds of ancillary crime that has nothing to do with Russia. I'm no fan of Trump, but unfair attacks may backfire. Many people have had their lives ruined by this investigation for crimes that would otherwise never have seen daylight. Help me understand if this investigation is appropriate or a witch hunt. I am ashamed of my liberal Democratic colleagues." What's your response to that?
My response is that it is not a witch hunt. In this particular case, he's correct, though, that once a special counsel gets started, the mandate that Special Counsel Robert Mueller had was very broad. And it tends to be what happens, whether it's an independent counsel or, in this case, a special counsel. And that's what happens. And Mr. Mueller has not made any bones about that or apologies about that. What's interesting about Cohen's case, though, was that it was a case that Mueller passed off from his portfolio to the Southern District of New York and said, this is your case, you can handle this. And so we've seen some cases where he's decided that maybe the evidence will circle back to his range of investigation, but that the Michigan listener is trying to pay attention to why is Mueller prosecuting this trial against Manafort. Mm-hmm. And that's supposed to begin in just days. And Manafort's the alleged crimes against him have nothing to do with the Trump campaign so far.
Mm-hmm. Josh, obviously, the president himself has called this a witch hunt. There are members of Congress who want to portray this as a witch hunt. Now, Mueller reports to the Deputy Attorney General on this particular case, Rod Rosenstein, and about a dozen conservative Republicans this week were calling for the impeachment of Rosenstein. Why? And what chance do they have?
Well, they are the most diehard of Trump's supporters. They're the mostly Freedom Caucus members on the conservative wing of the party. Trump is very popular in their districts, and they, I think, want to undermine the credibility of the Mueller investigation. This is not going to go anywhere. It's Paul Ryan, the House Speaker, put the kibosh on their efforts yesterday. I think the bigger story is that you only have about a dozen House Republicans that are willing to go this far. And if anything, the political momentum is against the anti-Mueller Republicans in the House, especially given what happened in Helsinki last week, given some of the new developments that have taken place in the last month regarding Trump and Russia. I mean, if you talk to a lot of House rank-and-file Republicans privately, there is real concern about what's going on between Trump and Russia and the relationship. So you have 11 out of almost, 200 House Republicans. That's a pretty small percentage. And if anything, I think the momentum is declining for any kind of witch hunt against Rosenstein.
But it lets those Freedom Caucus members and others sort of posture themselves and sort of out-conservative everyone else when they, by calling for Rosenstein's impeachment. But
it's not a real thing.
I don't think it's a real thing. We saw Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who had to recuse himself from being involved in this whole investigation because of his role in the campaign, come out and say, Rosenstein is a good guy, basically, and affirm him. And so, yeah, I don't think it goes anywhere. But I think the big reason it's not a witch hunt is because, we know overwhelmingly from the U.S. intelligence community that Russia did interfere in the 2016 campaign and wants to do so again. And so if members of the Trump campaign were involved in that, that's something the American public needs to know, and that's why Mueller's looking at this.
It also scrambles the politics. I mean, Jeff Sessions is a huge hit with a lot of conservatives, that even the ones that like Trump, and yet Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, defended Rod Rosenstein in no uncertain terms this week. So, even the more conservative pro-Trump Republicans, a lot of them like Sessions, and they're taking Sessions' side over these 11 House Republicans.
Now, Alexis, another name to come into this just this week arrived when the Wall Street Journal reported that Mueller's team has subpoenaed Alan Weisselberg. And Alan Weisselberg is the longtime chief financial officer of the Trump Organization. So now we're not talking about the campaign, we're talking about the Trump businesses. And it's a little bit unclear whether this report is accurate, whether there was a subpoena or whether Weisselberg was asked to answer questions voluntarily. But what does it mean to this whole ball of wax that he's now potentially going to be talking to law enforcement?
Well, the article was interesting because it also quoted someone familiar with Weisselberg's thinking, which is always a clue that there's going to be more to come about what it is that he has in mind. And it seems that Weisselberg is willing to discuss and to contrast his memory of what occurred depending on what Michael Cohen has told the investigators, prosecutors. So he's actually using his cooperation to call into question Cohen's veracity, his truth, which would be helpful to the president, right? He may be suggesting that Michael Cohen himself was guilty of fraud and that he knows it, that he became knowledgeable about it.
I want to move on to another story. After Helsinki, we might recall, a few days after that, the president came back and he invited Vladimir Putin to the White House, but then it was postponed. I want to talk about why the invite happened and then why it was postponed. But first, we want to make it clear that members of Congress were not very happy about this.
We will certainly not be giving him an invitation to do a joint session. That's something we reserve for allies.
Well, I can only speak for the Congress. The Speaker and I have made it clear that Putin will not be welcome up here at the Capitol.
All right. So why did this invite go out in the first place? Does anybody know what the president was thinking, or is that part of the problem in this case that we don't know what happened behind their closed-door meeting in Helsinki?
That is part of the problem. It's not clear all of his advisors know exactly what happened. And I don't know. I can't read the president's mind. I say this on a regular basis. But what we do know is that he has repeatedly said that we want to be friendly with Russia and has obviously shown friendliness, more friendliness toward Vladimir Putin in many cases than our European allies. So this seems in keeping with that.
Yeah.
This is a week where we have seen how detached the president is from his own administration. His own Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, was on the Hill, and even a lot of Senate Republicans, including the Foreign Relations Chairman, Bob Corker, were trying to make the point that the president's words matter. And even though Pompeo was trying to make the case that their policies are a lot different than the rhetoric we've heard in the past couple weeks, that this administration, the head is attached to the body, so to speak. It's a big political problem. That invitation to Putin, it sounds like it came directly from Trump without a whole lot of consultation with his top foreign policy advisor. And it's a big policy problem. It's a big political problem taking place before the midterm elections when Republicans do not want to talk about Russia.
I want to point out the voices we heard from Capitol Hill objecting were Speaker of the House Paul Ryan and Senate Majority Leader McConnell. But speaking of the Hill and the fact that Secretary of State Pompeo went up there, Alexis, characterize for us what Josh was just talking about. It seemed as though the questioners were trying to get to a sort of a basic, simple clarity. And Pompeo really, really put up a fight.
He did. He had been giving some interviews earlier before his testimony, and journalists were paying close attention to how he was describing the nearly two-hour meeting between Presidents Trump and Putin. And all he would say in these interviews was a lot of things were discussed. And it became clear as time went on that there was no clear narrative or readout about what was discussed, and that it was, as Josh describes, a struggle, almost a chaotic struggle inside the administration to find out exactly what was discussed. In the case of the testimony, Secretary Pompeo took a very interesting tack, which was to be combative with his questioners about what occurred in Helsinki, but to reassure them that nothing occurred in Helsinki. In other words, he said, you know, the president was, you know, he was within his rights to have this meeting. This was a good idea. The president succeeded in opening the door to communications. I think this is a good thing. I support this idea. And he got very, you know, terse with them. But then he reassured them that policy, U.S. policy, had not changed. And he went through a litany of descriptions about the tough action that the United States and the administration had taken against Russia to reassure lawmakers who, in a bipartisan basis, were just skewering the Secretary of State about how difficult it is to understand what foreign policy is.
And there were indications from Russian officials, they said, about what may have happened behind closed doors. They said that Trump and Putin talked about some pretty big issues like, you know, Middle Eastern tensions and North Korea and
Crimea
and nuclear arms. So, you know, not small issues. We don't know for sure from the White House, though.
As we began the program, we were talking about the fact that the GDP number had come out and we were waiting to hear what the president had to say. And now we've heard a little bit.
Business and consumer confidence has reached historic highs. So far this year, American exports are up nearly 20%. I've only been here a little more than a year and a half, over the same period in the year before I took office. We've become a net exporter of natural gas for the first time since 1957. Gotten rid of tremendous amounts of regulations, which allows us to do things.
And Sarah McCammon, he's also imposed tariffs, and that has stirred up a story and reaction and counter-reaction, and that's come back to bring farmers and soybeans into the news. And you used to cover that part of the country. So
Yeah. Talk
to me about the tariffs issue and the soybeans and where we all stand on that.
Well, the idea of steel and aluminum tariffs, you know, that's been popular with part of Trump's base, right, with the metals industry and manufacturing to an extent. But the idea of creating a trade war with China is not so popular with farmers who rely really heavily on trade, right, to sell their products, the soybeans that they grow, the hogs that they export. And this has caused a problem, as we alluded to earlier. This has caused a problem in the Midwest and other parts of farm country because China's not happy about these tariffs and other allies are not happy about these tariffs and have reacted with retaliatory measures. And we have seen, for instance, soybean prices drop something like 20% since those those tariffs were announced. So now the president has to figure out how to smooth things over with this big part of his base. He's told farmers again and again in public statements, you know, trust me here, stay with me. You're going to feel some pain at first, but this will all work out really well. And what we saw in recent days was this $12 billion bailout through direct payments and other means to help out farmers who are feeling this pain, trying to ease that pain a little bit.
How do farmers feel about being the beneficiary of a bailout?
Well, you know, on the
I'm sure in the short term, better than nothing, but what about in the longer term?
You know, farmers, by and large, tend to be conservative. They tend to be conservative states, and at least in philosophy and principle, opposed to government subsidies. But let's point out that for a long, long time, agriculture has been the beneficiary of massive government subsidies through the farm bill, the farm programs. But what farmers often have told me is that, you know, they want those to be there as a safety net for when things go badly, to keep our food supply stable, to keep the ag economy stable. But really what they want is trade policies that help them, that benefit ag, that they can, you know, they want to keep those soybean prices high because that's when they make a lot of money.
And Joshua, we're in a situation where the president, where we're in a trade war with China, but the president has announced the trade war with Europe is coming to an end. Talk about that.
So we think that he's backed down from some of the more stringent tariffs, but we don't have any deal, and it's still very much a whole lot of uncertainty in our relationship with the EU and trade. And it's, you know, back to Sarah's point, the political alliances have been totally scrambled when it comes to trade. So the Missouri Senate race, one of the most important Senate races in the country, you have Claire McCaskill, a Democrat, who's talking about the importance of the free market and in opposing this $12 billion bailout to farmers. She's saying, you know, the farmers want to compete on their own. They don't need a government handout. And you have the Republican running as one of the more conservative challengers in the country, Josh Hawley, the state attorney general, who's saying, well, you care more about the free market than you do about farmers. I mean, this is a reversal of where the parties have been. And this is one of the marquee Senate races in a farm ag state, Missouri, and a big battleground for 2018.
Alexis?
I was so struck this week listening to particularly senators, Republican senators on Capitol Hill, who were just livid about the $12 billion subsidy program and were not shy about talking about it. And whether they were, for instance, Chuck Grassley from Iowa, who cares, you know, deeply for the farmers in his state, to Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, who complained that it's a bad policy. And also, by the way, our fisheries in Alaska are not getting a bailout. What about us? You know, in other words, the complaint was, okay, why are farmers getting all the bailout, people clawing for some other element of it? Josh is so right that it has really scrambled the political dynamic. But I don't think we can understate in any way how fearful Republicans are that this is a policy heading in the wrong direction for them in the fall.
Alexis, there was a deadline for the government, federal government, this week to reunite families separated at the border. How did the government do with that?
Well, the deadline was last evening. There will be today additional hearings before the judge in California who's presiding over this litigation, which was brought against the government by the ACLU. The government says, based on its numbers, that they have achieved the reunifications that they had been ordered to do by the court to the extent that they were able to put together the children who were eligible to come back to their parents. And the word eligible is important here because the government wanted to redefine some of the metrics that they were responsible for achieving and, in fact, change some of the numbers. But the basic point is that they're arguing that they've put together families about more than 1,400 back together. Now, remember, these families are reunited in detention centers and in the United States at the southern border, big, large facilities. And what's going to be discussed today is what happens to initiate deportations, because the law still says that while they've been reunified, the parents and the children can't stay together forever. Mm-hmm. So in this case, that's the next proceeding. It's also interesting some of the decisions that the government had to make. For instance, more than 400 parents had been deported. In other words, they couldn't be reunified with their children in the United States. And so there's additional discussions that are going to happen about what happens to them. And then in addition,
Is there no obvious logistical path to solving that particular problem?
The government has been trying to do that, but it's a more challenging circumstance because you then have to have the safe transport of children back to their home countries in Central America in most cases. And so the government will have to, the judge will have to weigh in with the government to help direct how soon that has to happen. The other thing I wanted to mention is it's heartbreaking to hear, but the government said that 120 children, their parents decided that they did not want to reunify them, that they wanted their children, since they had already gotten into the United States, to go with relatives in the United States. In other words, they forfeited their children.
April on Facebook asks this question. In light of the news today that no efforts will be made to reunite children with parents that have already been deported, I'm not sure it's that clear cut. But who will be responsible for the next step for these children who are, she puts in quotation marks the word orphan. She's making clear she knows that they're not technically orphans, but that they are right now quite exposed and their parents are missing, or they were missing, however we want to put this. But she's really asking, what happens? Do they get put up for adoption? What happens with social services? I don't know that any of you knows the answer to that, but you might have some thoughts on it.
I don't know the full answer, but I know that I think it depends is the short answer. I mean, there are those who have gone to be with relatives or friends. There are hundreds of children still in custody of the federal government, and others who, you know, may be in foster care of various kinds. And I think that the overarching point here is that it's not clear at all that the government had any real plan for how this was supposed to work out. Children were separated from their parents as a result of the zero tolerance policy put in these facilities. And then what? And again, there's still many children whose situation is up in the air.
I was going to say that the courts are really driving the policy. I mean, it actually is pretty impressive that once the courts weighed in and said you have a deadline to the time which you need to reunite the families with their children, it got done pretty efficiently.
What I'm wondering about is if we go back a couple of weeks ago, I mean, people's hair were on fire about this issue, and then steps were taken. But when we're talking about still several hundred kids not being in a position to be reunited, where's the fire on this?
Well, I hesitate to suggest that there isn't a fire, because you can see that the advocacy groups, what's happening in the courts, the number of volunteers, especially in communities where these children have been brought into some sort of shelter, or as Sarah was suggesting, foster care, or these groups that are paid actually by the government to handle this. And you can see in the states that are dealing with this challenge politically, whether it's New York, the governor is talking about it. It's in Texas. You can hear the Texas lawmakers talking about it. And in the news, as I was looking at the news all day yesterday and today, you can read these really interesting, as Sarah was suggesting, case-by-case explanations and stories. But one of the reasons why we don't see it in the news, like cable news, for instance, is the government has made great efforts with the organizations it's contracted with to keep the media away. So we're reading lots of cases in which even the lawyers who are advocates, the attorneys who are advocates for these children or their families, are having trouble being able to get access and to find out information. So I don't want to suggest that we're in the news media not paying attention, because I do believe we are.
There are lots of reporters still down on the border. NPR's own Ari Shapiro has been down there with the team, and I think a lot of the revelatory information I've seen reported has come often through those attorneys for the children, who are, in many cases, the people who they're there to advocate for them and have the closest access the media does not have.
So here is a really stunning, mind-bending story from the week that you might have missed. A lawmaker in Georgia named Jason Spencer is resigning effective July 31st after he repeatedly shouted the N-word in the context of a new TV show produced by Sacha Baron Cohen. This show is called Who is America? And in it, Cohen pranks politicians on both sides of the aisle. He basically disguises himself as somebody else and sets people up in absurd situations, and they act very often in absurd ways. And here he is in a clip with Jason Spencer, the lawmaker. Spencer believes that he is getting a self-defense class from an Israeli anti-terrorism expert.
In America, there is one forbidden word. It is the N-word. Now, I am going to be the terrorist. You have 3 seconds to attract attention. Go!
No!
Are you crazy? The N-word is Nuni. Not this world. This world is disgusting.
So, I don't know. I see looks of shock and smiles as well on the panel here. Do you laugh at this, or is it heartbreaking or cringeworthy?
Definitely cringeworthy. I mean, it
gets worse, by the way. Yes. If you see the show, worse things happen.
I watched it because of all the news about it, and I found it terribly uncomfortable to watch. A lot of people find it funny. You know, it's hard to be too sympathetic or feel too sorry for someone who is shouting words like that and behaving in a shocking way. But this is what... This is what, you know, Sacha Baron Cohen is known for, right? Setting up these elaborate sort of ruses and getting people to embarrass themselves. Yeah, I don't know what to say except for wow.
Not the best and the brightest to fall for a prank like this. And, you know, he actually lost his, Jason Spencer lost his Republican primary even before any of this stuff came out. So, you know, sometimes I mean, Cohen likes to kind of prank sort of the lower level political officials. He cast a wide net for this show, but the people who have gotten the most embarrassment from it are the ones who are sort of the not ready for primetime players.
All right. Well, the recipients of this year's prestigious Kennedy Center Awards were just announced. They are composer Philip Glass, jazz artist Wayne Shorter, and the creative team behind the Smash Broadway hit Hamilton. Not much of a surprise there. And rounding out the honorees are two women who started their careers as singers and then transitioned seamlessly into acting.
I don't know why I did the things I did. I don't know why I said the things I said. Rides like a knife, it can cut deep inside. Words are like weapons, they wound sometimes.
Mama washed and combed and curled my hair, and she painted my eyes and lips. Then I stepped into a satin dancing dress that had a split from the side, cleaned up to my ear. It was red velvet trimming and it fit me good. Standing back from the looking glass, there stood a woman where a half-grown kid had stood.
So if you didn't pick it out, those were the voices of Cher and then Reba McEntire. Cher was singing If I Could Turn Back Time. Reba was singing Fancy. Both of these women are going to be honored in December by the Kennedy Center for their artistic and cultural contributions. By the way, it is not clear whether or not President Trump will attend the ceremony. That is the tradition, but the president declined to attend last year's Kennedy Center honors so as not to be a political distraction. I'm just wondering if Trump does go, do any of you think that he'll, you know, we saw at Hamilton that the cast actually spoke out when Mike Pence went there. Do you think the president is wise not to go to these?
Oh, no, I think it's terrific if a president does go. And it is the cultural salute event. And the president, any president, should want to go and be part of it. The president also understands that he has lots of detractors in the artistic community, whether it's music or the arts. But, you know, he says he's a tough guy and he should go. He should definitely go. I was also interested in one of the articles that I read. The reporter spent a lot of time asking the artists whether they were going to come if he showed up.
We talk a lot about the art of politics, but here we have the politics of the arts taking. I want to thank all of my guests. Alexis Simmendinger is a national political correspondent for The Hill. Great to have you here, Alexis.
Good to see you.
Josh Kraushaar is political editor for The National Journal. Thanks very much, Josh.
Thanks, John.
And Sarah McCammon, political reporter for NPR. Have a great weekend, Sarah.
Yeah, you too.
We'll be back with the international roundup after this.
Support for 1A and the following message come from American Express. These days, keeping up with everything in the news is hard, whether it's politics or pop culture. American Express believes it's always easier to stay ahead when there's someone behind you, easier to focus on what matters, to follow what interests you, to explore, to discover. And with American Express, you don't have to go it alone because they have your back. Don't live life without it.
I'm Shankar Vedantam, host of the podcast Hidden Brain. All summer long, we're sharing stories about reinventing yourself as part of a series that we call You 2.0.
Rebels are not troublemakers. They're people who break rules that should be broken.
Subscribe and embrace your inner rebel. No leather jacket required.
The U.S. Air Force picks up what could be the remains of American troops killed in the Korean War. The transfer of those remains was arranged by North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un and President Trump when they met last month in Singapore. Former cricket star Imran Khan claims victory in Pakistan's election for the country's next prime minister. Political opponents are saying the voting was rigged. And tensions between the U.S. and Iran ratchet up after Iranian officials trade barbs and Secretary of State Pompeo. President Trump responds with threats against Iran on Twitter, all in caps, and a deal with the European Union averts a trade war for now. Joining me for the global edition of the Friday News Roundup, David Lawler, who is world news editor at Axios. David, welcome to 1A.
Great to be here.
Barbara Platt Osher, who is State Department correspondent for the BBC. Welcome, Barbara.
Hello, John.
And Yoki Driesen, former foreign editor of Vox and author of The Invisible Front. Welcome back, Yoki.
Thanks, John.
Before we get to everything that I just ran through, news from the White House about the back and forth issues of President Trump and President Putin of Russia's extending invitations to each other. Barbara, what's the latest?
Well, the latest is that it looks as if President Putin has invited Mr. Trump to Moscow, and the White House has said that he is open to that if he gets a formal invitation, and that's turned things around because Mr. Trump had invited Mr. Putin to Washington, as we know, and then that was delayed last week by John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, who said they'd wait until the investigation into the Russian meddling was over, although he called it something else. So back and forth, we'll see when this meeting actually happens.
What do you read into this choreography?
Well, I mean, I can't say for sure, but I know that the Russians had not accepted, the Kremlin had not accepted the invitation to Washington. They had said that they would meet, but there would be other options, perhaps on the sidelines of a G20 meeting. So perhaps Mr. Putin wasn't eager to come to Washington. Also, of course, Mr. Trump was under fire for the summit in Helsinki, so perhaps it was that played a role as well.
If we can engage in just a small bit of speculation, not a lot, but David Lawler, what do you think would be the implications of President Trump going to Moscow to have a meeting soon?
So before that, I just wanted to mention that this is another thing that appears to have come out of the one-on-one between Trump and Putin. Putin says he invited Trump to Moscow in that meeting. Again, we haven't heard much from the U.S. side about what they discussed, but the Russians are kind of bit by bit getting out their side of the story. As far as the implications of a meeting, I mean, they've said the ground is not fertile for another meeting right now with all that's going on, and especially given how it went in Helsinki. It could be a do-over for Trump. Does he take a harder line with Putin this time around? Or are we right back to where we were after Helsinki, where the whole world is kind of crowding around him and telling him he's got the wrong play on Russia?
Yoki?
So I had two thoughts when I saw this. The first is that the Russians are incredibly savvy readers and interpreters of American politics, setting aside shapers, active meddlers in American politics. They saw the backlash to Helsinki, and you saw the Kremlin's language about the summit shift subtly. So when Russia said they weren't necessarily in a rush to come, part of that is thought to reflect Kremlin understanding as well that this was not a good meeting from the U.S. point of view. Mm-hmm. That if anything, it stirred up more anti-Russia feeling within Congress, within the Senate, within the Republican Party than existed before. So from their point of view, not going back to an immediate meeting with Trump makes a lot of sense. Also, not to make light of it, but Trump's last major visit to Moscow, which was before he was presidential candidate, let alone before he was president, was something that is now at the center of a lot of the collusion concerns, a lot of the questions about does Russia have something on Donald Trump? Is there a videotape showing various scatological acts that might be looming over Donald Trump? So the notion of him going to Moscow, it's fraught. It isn't simply him going to a foreign capital. It isn't simply him meeting a foreign leader. Moscow specifically and the rise of Donald Trump occupies a unique place.
Is it the sense that he's inviting himself to be invited, or that there's indications that the Russians are inviting him outright?
You know, there's a sort of alpha male thing with Trump that there's been from the beginning, and Putin similarly from Putin's beginning of power. And you wonder sort of, is this Trump saying, I will invite you and then maybe I'll go? Or is this Putin saying, aha, I'll invite you and have you come to my country where there is no political backlash to you coming and there is no nettlesome politicians condemning you like there would be if I, Putin, went to Washington?
Right. Barbara, Russia is so much in the news and related to when we're talking about President Trump and the administration's foreign policy, but there's also a second story that was really cooking up this week. Again happening in terms of things being said publicly. And I'm talking about Iran. And let's go back to Sunday when Secretary of State Mike Pompeo spoke to a group of Iranian Americans at the Reagan Presidential Library. Here's just part of what he said.
The Ayatollahs are in on the act, too.
Judging by their vast wealth, they seem more concerned with riches than religion. These hypocritical holy men have devised all kinds of crooked schemes to become some of the wealthiest men on earth while their people suffer. The level of corruption and wealth among Iranian leaders shows that Iran is run by something that resembles the mafia more than a government.
All right, so that was the Secretary of State, and then the president himself that same night sent out a tweet in all caps directed at Iran's President Rouhani. What did he say?
He said, "Never ever threaten the United States again or you will suffer consequences the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered before. Be cautious." And it was all in caps, although he does tweet a lot in caps. This seemed to take it to another level of caps, which was quite bellicose, obviously. And people wondered if he was threatening military action and why he had responded at that point in that way. It seems he was responding to things that President Rouhani of Iran had said, although the rhetoric wasn't so out of place or unusual, I should say. Mr. Rouhani had said, if there is war with Iran, it will be the mother of all wars. But he'd also said if there's peace with Iran, it will be the mother of all peace. So there was a question mark about why Mr. Trump was responding so vociferously.
David, do you have any thoughts on that? What triggered something? You know, as Barbara's saying, what the Iranians were saying was not as all caps-ish as what the president responded. Do you have any sense of what triggered that?
I would never accuse President Trump of having a nuanced view of this sort of thing. I mean, I think he probably saw it through a cable news filter, and maybe that's the clip that he saw was the mother of all wars. And I think that President Trump, you know, he likes to have this pattern where if he hears anything that resembles a threat, you know, he'll go over the top, he'll go all caps. And in terms of Iran, you know, the line can't be hard enough from his perspective. And that's, you know, sort of been his rhetoric on Iran since before he was president.
So I think maybe I'm hearing you saying it might not mean all that much, that it might have been very, very spontaneous and impulsive, but not actually representing a strong reassertion of policy.
I mean, the Trump playbook from the beginning is if you have a bad news day and a bad news cycle, change the topic. Yeah. And if you can change the topic from you did terribly in Helsinki, you have a trade war costing your base, to suddenly you're cracking down on Iran, even if that's the news cycle for a day, that's kind of a win. It's very important to know that the Pentagon itself, which would obviously be responsible for carrying out a military campaign against Iran, nothing has shifted. There are no aircraft going, there are no aircraft carriers going, there are no extra troops going, there are no preparations whatsoever for anything with Iran. So I was texted by friends in the region after the tweet. Usually when there's bad news in the U.S., you sort of text back, yeah, it's really bad, you should worry. This is not one of those moments. This is not a moment where war is imminent. There's nothing substantively changing.
Barbara?
Yeah, I completely agree with that, in terms of President Trump. What people are watching, though, is the fact that he has ideologues around him who have a history of being quite confrontational with Iran, one of them being Secretary Pompeo. And I was in California at that time for Mr. Pompeo's speech to the Iranian-American community, as you played. And he was really ramping up the pressure. It's not just economic pressure. They are really targeting the regime with the communication strategy of accusing them of corruption, of even saying there are no political moderates in the regime. President Rouhani is not a political moderate. He's just a cover. And making a direct appeal to the Iranian people, and they had Iranian Americans in the audience, of course. Mr. Pompeo was careful not to directly say he was calling for regime change, but he went about as far as he could. He basically laid out the case for rebellion and sort of championed the cause. So that kind of rhetoric and a certain amount of action is happening at the same time.
And is there a ready audience in Iran for that sort of rhetoric from the United States?
Well, The analysis is that it's not going to benefit or strengthen the protests of the people of Iran, because what Mr. Trump's policy has done is cause the elites to unite and strengthen the hardliners. Mm-hmm. Now, I was speaking to Iranian Americans. They're very divided about what they think should happen. They're divided on whether there should be sanctions or not, whether they think it hurts the people, which it does, or whether they think ultimately it's a good thing, whether they want American help to change the regime. And a lot of the people who were at the speech were for regime change, but even they thought they were getting mixed messages from the administration. One of them said to me, "Mr. Trump talks very tough against Iran, and then suddenly he says, oh, we want to make a deal. We can't do a deal with these people." Another person said to me, I thought Mr. Pompeo was for regime change, but he doesn't actually specifically say it. Another one said, actually, we know what he's saying. So they're a bit confused by what the administration actually has in mind.
And David, back in May, the U.S., under the president's direction, pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal, which was an Obama administration policy. How does that fit into this narrative?
I think that is the more important narrative here because, you know, we're still waiting for the full bite of U.S. sanctions to come back into force, which seems to be, you know, on track to happen. You still got the Europeans saying they can salvage this thing, and the Russians and the Chinese are kind of, you know, they have interests there as well. But the question is, at what point does Iran say, okay, this is a farce, we can't save this deal, we can't get the economic benefits we were promised, and go in a direction that makes things even more unpredictable?
So Pakistan held a quite raucous general election this Wednesday for their soon-to-be prime minister. Interestingly, it's only the second time in Pakistan's 70 or 71-year history that there's been a transition between civilian governments. So often the military has intervened, and the military is always in the background in Pakistani politics. But what's happened is that a former international cricket star named Imran Khan has named himself the winner, despite allegations that the vote was rigged and that there was coercion behind the scenes. Barbara, what do we know about how that election was run?
Well, there seemed to have been the main dynamic of it, and there were several, was these accusations that the military was targeting the governing party, the Pakistan Military League of Nawaz Sharif, who is in jail on corruption charges, and was supporting Imran Khan. So there were allegations that the run-up wasn't fair and that Mr. Khan was benefiting from military support. And then during the election itself, there were a lot of allegations of fraud, which are still being claimed. And as you said, Mr. Khan has claimed a victory, but they're still looking into those allegations. So we'll see how quickly he's able to take to form a government, because if the opposition is going to keep up with the protests, then that might be difficult. But it is interesting to see Imran Khan in this position. When I was in Pakistan about 10 years ago, he had entered politics. Of course, he was this flashy cricket star, but by then he'd sort of reinvented himself.
Well, so let's stop there for folks who don't know, because the flashy cricket star is, you know, he used to do Pepsi commercials. He's darn good looking, athletic, Oxford educated.
Oxford educated, yes.
He's a very smooth customer and not somebody you would have predicted would go into politics, but he has gone into politics quite seriously. So tell me a little bit more about his image before he became a politician. Or did I just cover it all?
Yeah, you covered a lot of it. But yeah, a celebrity for sure. He also had a reputation for womanizing, you know, partying, that sort of thing. But he did reinvent himself in the 90s, so a while ago, as a kind of pious, populist sort of politician, as an anti-poverty campaigner. But was very much on the margins for a long time because Pakistan's civilian politics are dominated by these two political dynasties, the PLN of Nawaz Sharif and then the Pakistan People's Party of the late Benazir Bhutto. And he has presented himself as an alternative third force. And when I was there, he was still very much on the sidelines. But I do remember young people being very enthusiastic about him. Mm-hmm. They thought he would bring change. And that is the bulk of his support, as well as the middle class who believe that he is going to be able to fight entrenched corruption.
David Lawler, well, it was just mentioned that corruption was one of the issues. But my question to you is going to be, what is his appeal besides his personality? What are the policies that he's putting out there that it makes him the public responsive to him in a way that they never have been before?
He said in his victory speech that he's going to govern Pakistan in a way that it's never been governed before. By that, he means, and you know, it will be cleaner. It won't be corrupt. You know, he's definitely more tied to the religious parties.
And that's a transition for him. I mean, he used to not be, correct?
Right, correct. You know, he's now an ally of these sort of more hardline parties in a way that the two more moderate parties had kind of rejected that element of Pakistani politics to a degree. And so, you know, that's certainly part of his appeal. And also, as you mentioned, he has kind of an alliance with the military here that, you know, is more their opponents of the ruling party, but sort of out of necessity have become supporters of his. And so that wrangling behind the scenes certainly helped get him to this strong position that he came out in the election.
And Yoki, as Barbara mentioned, we have a former prime minister in jail, Nawaz Sharif, and he had represented I think it could be argued he had represented the kind of leader that the West might like Pakistan to see more of, in that he was downplaying conflict with India. He was not as responsive to Islamist interests as previous prime ministers. And what does it indicate that he's in jail and he represented those policies, and now he's Imran Khan is stepping up with somebody who actually is quite sympathetic to the Islamist cause?
I mean, it's very interesting. His family actually, in the run-up to the election, referred to the election as a soft coup, in describing the role of the military. The military in Pakistan has overthrown the civilian government on multiple occasions. There are reports that the military had put itself behind Imran Khan, that it was sending people either covertly or overtly to polling places to say vote for him, that they were trying to force opposition candidates out of the race. I mean, it's important to understand about Pakistan, for people who may not be as familiar, the two most important players in it by far are the military and the kind of religious establishment / religious dynamics in the country. Imran Khan smartly has managed to link himself to both. Mm-hmm. So he has support from the military. He used a phrase in describing his campaign of creating an Islamic welfare state, with the specific phrase he used. And that has a real resonance to it, because that implies a lack of corruption. The appeal of Islamic parties in much of the world is that they are not seen as corrupt. And it implies the state will no longer steal money, but will instead have better schools, which he talked about, better hospitals, which he talked about, better roads, which he talked about it. And so if you meld those things, you may not be Nawaz Sharif in terms of your outward facing. You may not be the leader of a country that the U.S. might want. But you are someone who exactly hits with sort of tonal perfection what a Pakistani wants to hear, which is non-corrupt, suitably respectful of religion, and has some relationship with the military that implies they will not overthrow him.
And Barbara, all three of you now have talked about the role of the military. So for the initiate to the issue of Pakistani politics, the thing that they should know about the military, not only that it's large, but that it's influential. But my real question is, what has it got going for it that gives it this role in society? Is it a matter of efficiency, organizational ability? Is it a sort of raw patriotism? Is it a sort of respectability that the military has? What is it?
Well, the military, I think, is the strongest institution in the country, and it very much sees itself as a sort of the guardian of Pakistani nationalism and has a sort of disdain for civilian politics, and the civilian governance has been very messy and has been very corrupt. And when I was there, it really felt like the military was almost like a colonial power. Like, it felt outside its military bases was, you know, it was sort of chaos, and it was the one who could bring order, and has...
There's some truth to that, though.
Yeah, I think there probably is some truth to that. And it has also exercised power, not only as how we've been discussing it here, but in the security realm, as has been widely reported for many years, that it has cultivated militant groups to work as to work as proxies in foreign policy, both in the conflict with India, and also to make sure it maintains a leverage in Afghanistan. So it's very much the power broker in Pakistan. And, you know, you do have a lot of well-educated, actually Western-educated, middle-class people in Pakistan, but they very seldom have had the ability to try to shape the country, because you either have these two political dynasties, one is a sort of industrialist-based, one is very feudalist, and then you have the military. So perhaps Imran Khan appeals to that sort of feeling, but I think he's going to have a relationship with the military if he's going to run the country smoothly.
We have a tweet from Stoic Supermensch, who writes, "My Pakistani-born friend told me years ago, that Khan was the future of Pakistan, that he will bring dignity back to their government." I want to pivot to looking at Syria, but before we do that, I want to look back at a comment that's just arrived on Facebook from Kathy on our discussion earlier about Iran. "I find it shocking," Kathy writes, "that the Trump administration thinks it should advocate regime change in Iran. Aren't we complaining about Russia meddling in our elections? I can't stand Donald Trump, but I don't want any other country helping to get rid of him. I'm sure Iranians feel the same." Let's talk about Syria now. The Syrian Civil Defense Force, this is a storied, much documented, almost legendary group known as the White Helmets. They're a group of Syrian civilians who, since the start of the Syrian civil war, have organized themselves to try to rescue civilians from the horror that's happening there. And they're very well respected. They were Nobel Prize contenders a couple of years ago. So 300 members of this group are right now stranded and seeking evacuation. They're in the southern part of Syria near the Golan Heights. The Golan Heights is the part of Syria that is controlled by Israel. David, what's going on with the White Helmets? How did this happen to them?
Well, we also saw a group of White Helmets be evacuated from Syria, and so we can kind of see the government's attitude toward these ones who are still stranded from what they said about the ones who were evacuated, which was basically it was a despicable act of Israel with the backing of the U.S. and U.K. to take these people out. They said they were, allied with terrorists and sort of a Western-backed institution. So this is kind of the misinformation that the regime has shared about the White Helmets. And so the idea that as the regime is closing in, there are more in harm's way is a particularly troubling one given the attitude that the regime has had so far.
What's going on down there? When I say down there, I mean southern Syria, Yochi.
So just to take a step back for one second, we don't really like to say it quite this bluntly, although we should. The Syrian civil war functionally is over and Assad has won. You know, there is fighting continuing. The Islamic State, which we may talk about a bit later on, is reemerging and fighting as well. But Bashar al-Assad, with the help of Russia, has reclaimed much of the country, including the last of the major rebel strongholds, Aleppo, which the White Helmets were seen in footage. Some of the most moving footage was them in Aleppo pulling bodies, in some cases, of children out of the wreckage at great personal risk. The rebels who are left have been pushed into one last province, Idlib province, in the southwestern part of Syria, and are sort of being bussed there, literally. The Syrian government is saying, if you will stop fighting elsewhere, we will push you to this one little corner. Theoretically, we're not going to bomb you to death while you're there. And so when you mention the White Helmets who are stranded, that's where they're stranded. They were moved from the active combat zones mm-hmm. to this little haven. And the question is, does that stay a haven or does it start to get bombed? To a point that David referenced earlier, a large percentage, although not all, of the White Helmets and their families, and it's worth noting that their family members were also at risk because of the work that they were doing in this really extraordinary operation, were taken from the Golan Heights through Israel to Jordan, and then in most cases now out of Jordan to places like Canada. So it's rare that you see cooperation between Arab countries who are at war with Israel, ultimately with Canada being the endpoint. But it's sort of a sad reflection that a group that was such a force for good on such a human, visceral level, you're seeing people, you know, take children out of wreckage, that these last kind of glimmers of hope are leaving. I mean, it tells you something very dark about the reality.
And then there was this issue of Israel getting involved with an air attack. Yochi, what happened there?
So you had two events that were both linked. One was a Syrian fighter crossed into Israeli airspace and was shot down. The other was two rockets flew from Syria and landed into Israel. The common thread between these is the Islamic State. We, the Trump administration, the U.S., like to say the Islamic State has been defeated. It has not been. It has reemerged and is fighting Bashar al-Assad. So ironically, the Syrian plane that was shot down was trying to bomb an Islamic State target. In trying to bomb the Islamic State, it flew into Israeli airspace. Israel shot it down. The rockets that hit into Israel were not fired by Syria. They were fired by the Islamic State. One of them was very near to Lake Kinneret, which is a very popular tourist place. I spent quite a lot of time there. It was packed on the day of the attack. Had the rocket landed in Lake Kinneret, it would have been catastrophic. Those rockets were not fired by the Islamic State in Israel. They were fired at Bashar al-Assad's army. So you have the Islamic State fighting Syria, and that conflict itself is threatening to bring in Israel.
I'm interested in how the rest of the panel reacts to your characterization of the Syrian civil war as basically being over.
Well, I think that Bashar al-Assad, with the help of the Iranians and the Russians, has taken over much of the country and is doing a mopping up operation now. There are parts of the country still controlled by the opposition, but it's definitely a trajectory towards the regime taking back control. And what you're seeing in southwest Syria is this pocket where, on the one hand, it's fighting Western-backed rebels who had been existing there under a ceasefire that had been brokered with Russia, which has now ended. This is where the White Helmets were stuck. But then you're also seeing this mopping up operation of ISIS-linked militants along the Israeli-occupied Golan border there. And the Israelis are watching very carefully. They're neutral. They don't intervene, but they have made very clear that there are red lines, and if any of those red lines are crossed, they respond. So as we were discussing, because the Syrian military aircraft came into their airspace, they shot it down. But the Syrians are not their problem as far as they see it. They are laser focused on Iran's military presence in Syria, mm-hmm. and a lot of their attention is focused on trying to make sure that the Iranians do not get close to their border or set up military bases. And they're in very close contact with the Russians about that, trying to arrange something so that the Iranians do not, they're not going to be in the sort of sights of the Iranians, so to speak. And we heard recently from President Putin that they what they want to do is reestablish the 1974 agreement, whereby they have a demilitarized zone, the Syrians police, the Syrian side of the borders, the Israelis on the other side. And there was a report in Israeli press recently that the Syrians and Israelis have actually met to talk about that. So the Syrians, in a way, you know, they don't want military aircraft coming into the airspace, but their concern is Iran.
And David Lawler, there's talk also, and Yoki alluded to this, of yet another agent in the mix, and that's ISIS, the possibility of ISIS regaining a foothold, reestablishing a foothold in Syria. That we had a terrible massacre take place in Syrian province of Soweida this week. How bad was that attack, and is it an ISIS operation?
It was an ISIS operation. They've claimed responsibility, and I think the
well,
latest.
Can you describe it? What did they do?
It was an assault by ISIS in southern Syria that killed upwards of 200 people. It seems very much to signal that, you know, given if Assad has won the civil war, which I agree, there's no likelihood of him being defeated militarily at this point. That, you know, their role here is not over. They're still there. And so it's pretty chilling that they were able to pull this off. Some of the most aggressive tactics we've seen from them, you know, in some time in Syria.
And so the bottom line is ISIS on the march again there?
It's a very complicated picture for ISIS in Syria. They're certainly not defeated, eliminated. They don't hold the kind of territory we saw previously. But, you know, these people are still there. It's not like they've all drifted off somewhere else. And so and many of them are still committed to the cause. And so we're going to see things like this continue to happen.
And Yoki, the same question to you, the ISIS question in Syria.
Very briefly, by the way, on Soweida, it's easy often for us sitting here especially to talk about things in kind of antiseptic terms. Soweida was particularly awful. You had ISIS very literally going to homes of families while they were asleep, killing the families, killing the wives, the children, and some, you know, slitting the throats, but of families while they were sleeping. Mm. You know, terror attacks, you could think of, if you fire a rocket, you don't see people on the other end. If you blow up a car bomb, you don't see them. But here you're looking in the faces of individual people as you murder them.
Okay, more when we come back. We are doing the global edition of the Friday News Roundup. We'll be back in a minute with journalist Yoki Driessen, Dave Lawler, and Barbara Plett Usher. Stay close. I'm John Donvan, and you are listening to 1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor ADT. America's trusted home security company can help protect you against break-ins, fires, and carbon monoxide. 24/7 emergency response when you need it most. More at ADT.com.
There's a new way to hear Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and all your favorite programs. Just ask your smart device to play NPR. Listen to your local station anytime, like this. Hey, smart device, play NPR.
Let's talk about North Korea. So the president and Kim Jong-un had a meeting in Singapore, out of which came a series of some vague-ish promises made by the part of the North Koreans, including an understanding that they would be dismantling a particular site. Well, now we are seeing satellite images that appear to show North Korea is dismantling its missile testing site. David, how trustworthy are these images?
It does appear to be happening. Some very close North Korea watchers have said the satellite images certainly show the dismantlement of this site. Now, as with everything else that we've heard with North Korea, there's a but there. I mean, this is a relatively outdated site. They have other facilities now where they would be able to test missiles if they wanted to. But this is more of somewhat of a goodwill gesture, and something that, you know, maybe Donald Trump can sell as a sign that there's progress here.
Is it a major step towards an actual denuclearization agreement? Everyone's shaking their heads very adamantly. No.
No, I mean, this was a site used for developing missiles that North Korea has long since shown an ability to test fire at will. The North Korean ballistic missiles that they've tested can reach much of the mainland United States, so they don't need to be developing missiles. They already have them. It's symbolic. It's a good thing in the sense that they're carrying out any promise, but I think David summarized it well with the word outdated. Mm-hmm. They no longer need a site like this. You know, the other part of the week with North Korea saying they'll return, as you alluded to before, the remains of some U.S. war dead, it's 55 bodies or parts of bodies, which for those families is an amazing gift, which shouldn't be downgraded or ignored. There are 5,500 missing U.S. service people still in North Korea.
In fact, there were over 7,000 unaccounted for from the war, but as you say, 5,500 who were believed to be in North Korea. This week, we actually touched on this program on 1A, and we spoke with Noreen Loper. She has a brother who is Airman James O'Mara, Jr. He was missing, has been missing since a plane he was in was shot down in Korea in 1953.
It's very heartbreaking, you know, to live not knowing one way or the other. We have no proof that James is dead. We have no proof that he is alive. But it is very, very heartbreaking to live with that day after day because you simply cannot let it go. But our search just continues on. Because as far as I'm concerned, when one American is not worth the effort to be found, then we as Americans have failed.
Obviously, a lot of pain there. And I'm guessing that Noreen is wondering if the remains coming back will include those of her brother. But what is this? What are the stages that these remains need to go through now before she can even begin to know the answer to that question?
So some of it is carbon dating and some of it is DNA testing. They need to make sure that the bones and the other remains actually are from the period that they are said to be.
Is there any doubt about that?
Yeah, because in the past, North Korea has returned remains before. And when the U.S. looked into the remains, they were a mixture of multiple bodies. In some cases, there were rumors that some of the remains included the bones of dogs and other animals that were not even human. The clothes were clothes that were not American military uniforms. So there is reason to doubt that these are all, that all of what was returned are the remains of American service people. But let's assume the best. Let's assume they are. There still is the question of making sure by carbon dating the clothing and also then trying to identify people. DNA testing now is more sophisticated, but mm-hmm. DNA samples from those soldiers may not have been taken 50-odd years ago. You know, what you played, that clip is heartbreaking, and you do hope that for some number of these 55 families, there is a small measure of closure and solace.
It's believed North Korea has over 250 human remains from this period. David Lawler, it sounds like the worst kind of amoral political football to be using, but that's what it is, isn't it?
I talked to some former U.S. officials who worked on this subject in previous administrations in trying to negotiate a broader search and recovery effort for remains. And so, you know, I talked to them about this discrepancy between the number that we think they have and the number that they're now turning over. It could be a question of these are the ones that they're most confident are the remains of U.S. troops. Mm-hmm. The other possibility is that they're doing the bare minimum to get a positive headline and keep as many cards as they can moving forward. You know, so obviously this is a positive step, but even the fact that we don't know whether they're turning over all of the U.S. troops that they have is pretty indicative of the lack of communication, first of all, and also just the lack of trust that exists in how the North Koreans tend to play these things.
Barbara, in terms of tensions easing compared to where they were 6 or 7 months ago in North Korea, we have South Korea announcing its plans to kind of calm things down at the demilitarized zone border that separates the two countries, that they're going to be pulling out some of their guard posts and some of their equipment. Significance of this?
Well, there was a summit between the South Korean and North Korean leaders before Mr. Trump's meeting with Kim Jong-un, and there they had agreed to cease all hostile acts and turn their border into a peace zone, so to speak. So these steps are meant to create that, or steps towards that. The South Koreans are more ready to take such steps, I think, than the United States would be. They are looking for reconciliation. It's not just a nuclear disarmament thing for them, although that is part of it. And it's interesting that the remains that have been returned have been done so on the 65th anniversary of the truce mm-hmm. that ended the North Korean, that ended the Korean War, And this is a big thing for both the South Koreans and the North Koreans. The North Koreans have said they want a treaty to end the war. They want a declaration to end the war. And they've said that is part of the agreement they made with President Trump. And so they would like to see it sooner rather than later, as with the South Koreans. The Americans are saying, well, we don't actually want to do that until you've taken some very concrete steps towards denuclearization. Because if we end the war, there's less international pressure for you to actually dismantle your weapons. So there's that tension, actually, between the North Koreans and the Americans. This has been a good news week for the North Koreans in a way. They've said, we're returning remains. We're dismantling our test site. Give us something back. We want to end the war, then we'll feel more secure, then we can denuclearize. So that's how they see the schedule, if you want to call it, of the agreement that was made with President Trump, whereas the Americans very much say this is all about denuclearization, and it's only when you show you're serious about that that we can do these other things.
To link back to a discussion we were having earlier in the program about the president's aggressive-sounding tweet aimed at the Iranians, the president sent similar tweets several months ago to the North Korean leader, and I believe he would make the argument that the forthrightness, let's say, of those tweets actually had an impact and led to this, let's say, little bit of progress that we're talking about. Do you think that in seeing him do the same sort of thing with the Iranians, that he has decided that this game plan works and that's what he's going to keep doing?
Possibly, if he's got a strategy behind it. And, you know, you can argue that the rhetoric, the hostile rhetoric, the kind of threatening fire and fury and having a military posture that was quite assertive did factor into Kim Jong-un's calculations, although also he completed his nuclear program and felt in a strong position to negotiate, which is the view of many analysts. So It's not only that. I think with the Iranians, I mean, it may have been a factor with Kim Jong-un. And with the Iranians, the dynamic is quite different. It's a politically complex state. It's not run by a dictatorship, so those kinds of decisions can't be made that easily. And they'll return pressure for pressure that they get, I think. Also, as I mentioned before, there's an ideological element to the administration on Iran. I don't think there was with North Korea.
Let's talk about trade for a bit. I want to first go to an email from Tom, who's written into us. It seems to me that China is really in the driver's seat when it comes to trade. If China starts buying soybeans from another source, can't they cut our farmers out? They are actively rerouting world trade to their benefit. So what can Trump really accomplish? Well, that tweet comes in a week when the president has announced that a potential trade war that was brewing with the European Union has now been put to rest. He and the president of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, met in Washington. They held a press conference in the Rose Garden. They announced that a deal was made on trade and that it included agricultural trade.
As far as agriculture is concerned, the European Union can import more soybeans from the US, and it will be done. And we also agreed to work together on the reform of the WTO. This, of course, is on the understanding that as long as we are negotiating, unless one party would stop the negotiations, we will hold off further tariffs.
So that was Jean-Claude Juncker. And what does this mean, Yoki, for the tariffs that the president imposed on aluminum and steel? I mean, what's the back and forth, first of all, between Europe and the U.S., and what does this have to do with the back and forth between China and the U.S.?
So on the first, there's been the confusion among Republicans has been twofold. One is, why, for a party that believes in free trade, are you doing this in the first place? Tariffs function effectively as taxes. They make purchasing stuff more expensive here, exporting stuff more expensive other countries. So there's been the kind of broader question. The second question is, why are you punishing American allies? Why are you hitting Europe, hitting the EU, hitting Germany, hitting France? And so to the degree you can step back, to the degree that you can hold off on tariffs, as you mentioned, on cars, hold off on tariffs on aluminum and steel, that's a big thing for Europe. A small thing, and kind of where Juncker overstated it, is when he said the EU can import more soybeans and it will be done. First of all, the EU buys almost no soybeans. Soybeans, when they're exported by the US, go to China by an overwhelming margin compared to what they go to Europe. So that's not really, it doesn't mean much. But also, Juncker is not the president of a country. He can't say, We will now buy something. He's head of the European Commission. He can recommend to the EU member states that they import more soybeans, but he can't actually order it. So this deal sounds great. It certainly is better than a full-on trade war, but it's really vital to understand that the promises Juncker made, he cannot necessarily enforce. By comparison, when Donald Trump issues a threat on tariffs, his power is largely unfettered. So if he decides to go back to tariffs on cars, go back to aluminum and steel tariffs, he can do that. Juncker cannot.
David Lawler, let's turn to China and the trade question now. The president's team argues that China is deliberately targeting soybeans in order to hurt the president and where his political allies are. Most of the farm states are quite conservative, that this is a targeted way to cause him extreme discomfort with his base. Actually, it sounds quite logical.
Yeah, of course they are. I mean, they know midterms are coming up in November. I mean, they're playing this in a relatively strategic way. I think they might have miscalculated early on, and they didn't think things would ramp up as quickly as they have. But there's certainly a strategy from their perspective. And some of President Trump's allies seem to take the $12 billion in subsidies for U.S. farmers as almost an admission of failure there, that he, you know, now has to bail out his base in order to support the trade war that he's fighting. And that's kind of ramping up the pressure. And that was all kind of in the background here before Juncker came to town and they signed this sort of ceasefire on trade. And so now I think if you're sitting in Beijing, you're wondering, did Trump blink? Is this a sign that he's looking to back down, at least in the time being, for political reasons? Or is he viewing the China dispute as a separate issue from the EU dispute?
Barbara, what do you think on the China, on the level of tension with China over trade? Is it stable? Is it getting worse?
Well, I think it's very troubling because neither side is backing down at the moment, and the Chinese are prepared to dig in. There's an issue, I think, that many Americans believe is valid with what Mr. Trump is talking about, which is especially the intellectual property rights. This is something the Americans mm-hmm. are developing and want to keep hold of, and the Chinese have a concern about what the Chinese are doing. But the tariffs that Mr. Trump is threatening, of course, many people here feel that is not necessarily the right way to do it. But as I said, the Chinese are not blinking, even if Mr. Trump is blinking for the Europeans, and I don't know if he would do so with the Chinese.
I want to mention, just take note of the fact that this overseas has also been a week of extreme weather and even extreme fires in a lot of places around the globe. There are wildfires moving very fast near and around Athens. They've killed more than 80 people. Europe has a heat wave, also fires in Britain, fires raging in Sweden as far north as the Arctic Circle, and Japan declared a national emergency as a heat wave was blamed for the deaths of at least 65 people. I'm mentioning this because earlier this week on 1A, we discussed some of these heat waves and what city planners are doing to help us stay cool. You can find that conversation on our website at the1a.org. Let's move now on to Canada. Terrible, terrible incident there. The nation still coming to terms with last weekend's shooting in Toronto. What happened there in the neighborhood called Greektown, a 10-year-old girl and 18-year-old woman were shot by a guy who walked down the street shooting into shops and restaurants. 13 people were wounded. So ISIS comes into this again. ISIS claimed an affiliation with the gunman who was 29 years old and who is now dead. Local law enforcement says it cannot substantiate that. But reaction from Canadian leaders has been tense and intense. Here's Ontario's premier designate, Doug Ford.
We have a bunch of thugs running around the city with guns, shooting people. And my prayers and thoughts go out to their families and the two little kids. It's heartbreaking. Every single person here, most people have children, and you can't even comprehend what the families are going through. These innocent two little kids being shot in the streets of Toronto. What's a city coming to?
David, very briefly, do we know for sure it was ISIS? Was he an ISIS guy?
We don't. They've claimed it. Canadian authorities seem to be downplaying the likelihood that there was a link there.
All right. Finally, let's turn to science. Science may be getting closer to the question of answer to an eternal question of whether there is life on Mars. The European Space Agency announced earlier this week that they believe that they have found a lake on Mars underneath the red planet's southern ice cap. It's most likely a very salty, concentrated brine. It would be tough for Earth-bound life to survive in. It's nevertheless the first time persistent liquid water has been found on another planet. And coincidentally, I want to let you know that tonight is a busy night out in the cosmos. Tonight, depending on where you are, you may see the longest total solar eclipse of the century, or a reddish-orange, what is called a blood moon. And if you might also catch a glimpse of Mars itself, the red planet is currently the closest it has been to Earth in 15 years. To my panelists, all of this discussion of the cosmos makes us feel small and altogether human, doesn't it? In this time of strife, it's great that we're all here on this little blue planet hurtling through the skies. Maybe we can all get together. I want to thank my guest, Yoki Driessen. Thanks very much for joining us, Yoki.
Thanks, Sean.
Barbara Platt-Usher, thanks for joining us, Barbara.
My pleasure.
And David Lawler, it's great to have you on 1A. Thanks very much. much, everybody, for listening. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm John Donvan. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.